it's been really great to see just leaning back into the multidisciplinary aspect, because then you're relevant to so many more people. There's only a certain amount of people in New York who enjoy theatre, and particularly Irish theatre. But when you bring music into a more enriched experience, and you're bringing now contemporary dance, which we can do in the new space, the literature programmes, the humanity programmes. And we've always taught 40 classes a week in Irish language, history, music and dance. We don't talk a lot about the education programme, but it's been phenomenal.
That was Pauline Turley from County Down and the Muse of Irish Arts in New York. And I'm John Lee.
And I'm Martin Nutty, and welcome to another episode of Irish Stew, the podcast for the global Irish nation.
This episode of Irish Stew is sponsored by the Irish Heritage Tree Program. Celebrate your Irish roots by planting native trees for family and friends in the beautiful Golden Vale of Ireland. Go to irishheritagetree.com and use the exclusive discount code today. It's IrishStew10 for 10% off. That code again is IrishStew and the numeral 10. Keep the heritage of Ireland green and growing by going to irishheritagetree.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Irish Stew podcast. I am Martin Nutty, and I'm joined here in our studio with John Lee. Welcome, John.
Hey, good to be back, Martin, and looking forward to today's conversation. You know, we talk to a lot of people, and we get into their career paths, and many of those paths are quite complicated. Our guests have changed jobs, changed roles, shifted into other fields, moved around the globe. But today's guest has held just two roles in the same organization for 26 years and 3 months. But there's nothing static about her career path. Her roles were executive director and vice chair, and the organization is the dynamic and ever-changing New York cultural landmark, the Irish Arts Center, now in a brilliant new facility. And that person joining us is the pride of County Down, Pauline Turley. On behalf of our listeners and Martin, welcome to Irish Stew.
Thank you, John. Yes, it says, I guess, two titles, but back in the day when I started at Irish Arts Centre, it was just me and a part-time person. So I think we could add cleaner, bar back, ticket, box office, marketing, teacher. It really, you know, was a baptism by fire. So, many labels underneath particularly the early days. We're very, very fortunate to have an incredible team at the Irish Arts Centre now. So I kind of celebrate when someone says, you know, what time does Boron start on Thursdays? And I don't know the answer. Right. It's like, that's not my job anymore. So, we're blessed with a wonderful, wonderful team at the new Irish Arts Center.
Well, let me open up the conversation with just something to get us thinking, a thought starter. And I've been reading Seamus Heaney lately, a great poet from your side of the border in Northern Ireland. And I just came across a quote, and I wonder if you respond to it at all, because it seems to match up with you quite a bit. Walk on air against your better judgment.
I still have people coming up to me and saying, you know, I thought you were mad. You had this mad, mad, harebrained dream and no money at the time. I mean, when I came across the Irish Arts Centre, it was 1997, and I came to New York for 6 months, as many people do. And I was very fortunate. My sister had always wanted to come to America and had applied for every green card lottery going. And while I was still a student, I went to Trinity to study drama. Thank God I've never been cursed with the desire to perform. I'm a terrible liar. The thought of getting up on stage and telling lies just petrifies me. But I always loved theater. I think it was my dad's amateur dramatics in the parish hall when I was seven. I used to learn all the lines with him that gave me the bug. And I had some wonderful teachers at the Sacred Heart School in Newry. Brenda Rankin ran an amazing drama department, very cutting edge at that time in the 80s, doing Beckett. And I thought Beckett was just normal theatre because that's where I had started. But, I got a green card. My sister put me into the lottery. The one and only time that she put my name in, I didn't even do it. So I kind of naively felt like I loved Dublin. I was living in Dublin at the time and having gone to college there. And I loved Trinity and the whole theater scene. And I thought naively, if I came to New York for 6 months and I proved myself I wouldn't like it, and then if I gave my green card back, then someone else who really wanted to be there would get a chance. And lo and behold, I came across the Irish Arts Center. And I have to say, you know, it was kind of embarrassment at the very beginning. I was like, I'd heard so many great stories being a drama student in Dublin. You know, Jim Sheridan had come over in the 80s, which is where Jim got his start, and Terry George. And there were so many wonderful people had passed through the doors, obviously, in the 70s and 80s. Frank McCourt and Malachy, that's where they did the, you know, their couple of blackguards back in the 80s. And, you know, legendary stories of Peter O'Toole on the stage and all casts of characters. And when I came, I was like, this is the Irish Arts Center, you know, this very humble tenement building, which was leaking. Micheál Martin, Antonister Micheál Martin, and I think he was the Minister for Foreign Affairs when he first came over to visit when we were talking about building a new Irish Arts Center. And there was literally buckets on the stage catching the rain. And he says, oh, you know, Paul and Aidan, you're putting this on a bit full. But I said, you know, I wish I was. This was, you know, the actual reality, because we were in a city-owned building. So we had to get city permission to do any kind of work. So it really, 97 for 6 months. And then the embarrassment, I was like, you know, we can do better than this. We can do better than this. So that's kind of, and it was air, walking on very thin air and no money in the bank, and really on a dream. We were very fortunate to get Gabriel Byrne involved in about 2000. We were doing a show called The Gingerman, which we had brought over from Dublin, and it happened to star Carl Hayden, whose mother, Terry, was Gabriel's agent at the time. So Gabriel was on the Charlie Rose show promoting Moon for Misbegotten, which he was starring on Broadway at the time. And I'm sure his producers wanted to murder him, because his closing moments on the Charlie Rose show was, I just want to say there's a great new show opening. I won't try and do a Gabriel impression. Opening at the Irish Arts Center. And, you know, it's running for a couple of weeks. Go and see it. Which I'm sure he was probably murdered for when he came off camera. But we got to know each other at that time through, he came to the opening night party, and we both felt he had spent a lot of time at the Arts Center in the 80s. And, you know, we were like, you know, you walked on Park Avenue in New York and you pass Asia Society. It takes up an entire block. Scandinavian Center, you've got Alliance Française. You have like at least four massive Jewish museums. And, you know, we didn't have a place that was fitting enough for the talent that was coming out of Ireland. Heaney, you mentioned, if Heaney came to New York, you know, we wouldn't put him in a crumbled down building on 51st Street. He'd go to Lincoln Center, or, you know, and it was, you know, so Gabriel and I got talking about, you know, how do we build our own mini Lincoln Center for the Irish that, you know, we can all be proud of? You know, a lot of people be like, yeah, we love, I mean, very proud of the work. I mean, that's what people, you know, the Irish Arts Center, very much a hidden gem. Once you went through those doors, the work was magical. Yeah. You know, getting to see Liam O'Mwainley there with Cassandra Wilson, the Grammy Award-winning jazz musician, half trad musicians, half jazz musicians, absolutely stunning work. But the building just wasn't up to par with the talent that was coming through, and in fact could come through. We were limited with what we could bring over.
So we're going to probe that history and that story deeply in the course of this hour. But as with all our guests, we like to roll the clock back a little bit. And as John alluded to, you're from Northern Ireland, Newry, or in the Newry area, as I understand it. So tell me about the origin story for Pauline Turley.
Well, I'm a very proud Colchie. Newry is the big schmuck. We would definitely be called Colchies by people from Newry, even though it's only 5-10 minutes out the road. I'm the fifth of seven kids. So I have four brothers and two sisters. So, and, you know, we were very average Irish family, working class, didn't realize it at the time. Nobody had any money in Ireland in the 70s and 80s. We had a mushroom factory on our road, several mushroom factories, which became the big craze, I guess, in the 80s. So late 70s, early 80s. So I started work at 7 at the mushroom factory, weighing mushrooms. And my neighbor I used to meet in the shops, you know, I guess about 10 years ago. And she said, I used to look out my window and say to my husband, oh, Jesus, check if the child's sitting on the front step. And I would have made my own lunch the night before. and walked. It was about a 10-minute walk from home, but it was on a country road. There was very little activity, but I would have set my alarm and got up, and I still kind of don't know where. But, you know, my parents are very, my parents are both very hardworking people. And being number five, my mother, I'm sure, was just absolutely exhausted at that point. So my older brother was working there. So I got him to get me a job, and off I went. And I bought my, I think, my first camera from my mushroom money when I was 10. So I guess I was interested in the arts and photography a bit. But, you know, it was expected. We would all pick potatoes in the potato season. And, you know, it was very humble, but very loving. My parents are, I guess, 60 years together this year. And I've never heard my father say a disrespectful thing about or to my mother in my life. I've never heard him raise his voice. The only thing that he regularly says is they broke the mold when they made your mother. So I was very, very blessed to grow up in, you know, a very humble, but very, very loving. And being surrounded by brothers, the girls were older and I had boys either side of me. I was very much a tomboy. So I think maybe part of it too was anything that they could do. I, you know, dad tells a funny story where he thought it was my elder brother, who was 16 at the time, on a motorbike taking a ramp. When he was driving down the road, he saw this motorbike in flight. And then realized, almost had a heart attack when he realized it was like 10-year-old me on the motorbike with the helmet, trying my best, Evel Knievel. So I think having the brothers either side of me just made me maybe a bit more adventurous. And also just kind of very much just have to get on with it. And you know, not my, seeing my parents' hard work was always, it was not an option not to be a hard worker. That was the role models that were kind of set for me. And I do remember a funny story. And I've dug a little bit deeper into this. When I was about five or six, maybe seven, I ran away from home, as you do when you're that age, you know. And I was literally hiding down the fields, about two fields away. And I could hear my brother calling my name one way and my mother the other. And I was like, yes, it's working, you know. And it was around the time of Little House in the Prairie. So I was thinking, you know, it was going to be this wonderful moment. I'd run home and my mother would grab me into her arms and it'd be Laura Ingalls Wilder's time, you know. And, you know, if I was dead, they'd be so sad right now. But I came home and my mother just looked me in the eye and said, the next time you run away, I'm locking the doors. You won't get back in. And I don't know whether something in me clicked and went, oh my God, at like seven, I better look after myself here because... Yeah. This could all go horribly wrong at any minute. I could be on the streets at any minute. So I don't know. I mean, I kind of tease my mom. It was the best line ever. I mean, it totally, well, she said it obviously didn't work because I eventually ran away to America. But, you know, I think in my head at seven, I was like, okay, I got to figure out how to do this on my own. So, you know, I am very proud that my part-time jobs, and we also had a shop in Newry, when I was a teenager, so I worked a lot of before school and after school in the shop. And, you know, that probably helped with the hospitality skills at the Irish Arts Centre. You know, we're really dealing with a lot of walks of life coming in on a daily basis. And so that probably led me to, and again, then it was the drama, the interest in drama that took me to college. And my parents were very, I was the first, my brother and I were the first in our, both my parents' generations to go to college. My mother, my parents, I was a straight A student and had maximum points in my leaving, as they call it at home. And my parents basically just wanted me to quit while I was ahead and not jinx it. And I really actually had to fight with my parents, really struggled to get them to understand my need to go to college because my older siblings hadn't gone and they were all doing very well working in, you know, my sister has been a doctor's receptionist. She knows so much more about pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, my father was in construction and the boys had followed him into that. So it really was, and especially to go and do drama. But in a way it was liberating because they had no expectations for me as at a higher level, that I was able to choose whatever course that I wanted to do. But at the end of the day, most of my friends were going to college. And it was a kind of a tipping point in Ireland in the early 90s is when it started to become more of a prerequisite if you wanted to go to college. Like in the 80s, you really didn't need to go to college in Ireland to get yourself set up for life. And then I feel like the tipping point kind of came in the early 90s when, you know, I think now we have one of the highest third level educations in Europe.
Well, Pauline, before we get you down to your next phase when you are in college, and to change the mood slightly, you grew up in what is called the Troubles. Did that impact your life? What was it like in Newry for you?
Well, you know, I absolutely love Derry Girls. And I was laughing so hard, my husband would usually just have to leave the room because I was getting so many of the jokes. So it kind of was a little bit like that. As a teenager, you didn't really understand what you were going through because that's all you knew. I mean, I was born in 1973. I'll be 50 this year. So I literally was born and lived it. Now, we had the luxury of being a pacifist because we grew up in South County Down. So we had Protestant neighbors, and literally our Protestant neighbor would drive my Catholic siblings till there became too many of us to fit in his car. He would drive them to school because he was driving to Newry anyway, and they would all be standing waiting for the bus, and he'd give them a ride to the point where he'd pick them up at the door, drop them off at school. And, you know, in the country, you know, neighbors kind of kept to themselves, except if there was a problem. So we had wonderful, wonderful neighbors. It's a very country road with generations upon you. I know at least 5-6 generations of us. The road that I grew up on, which is the Ryan Road, was the song that the famous song that Tommy Sands wrote about There Were Roses, which is about the Troubles and based on a true story. And that's actually 50 years this year because it was 3 weeks before I was born. And our neighbor's boyfriend, her fiance, got abducted from the house right next door to us. And my parents came across the car. They were literally driving us down the road. I was in my mom's belly 3 weeks before I was born. And they couldn't, it's a small country road. So the door was open and they were like, oh my God, Sean must have left in a hurry. And my mom closed the car door and they drove, you know, a couple of hundred yards down to our house. And then the neighbors came running saying that masked men had taken this young boy. And I think he was only 17 or 18, maybe 19 at the time. But it was in complete retaliation. He happened to be, unfortunately, from a place in South Armagh where a local Protestant man in Savile, where I grew up, had been murdered because he was a part-time police officer. And he was killed in South Armagh, so they knew. And it had to be a locals because they had to know that this young Catholic girl was dating a guy from that parish or that place. And he was not involved in any way, shape or form. So my dad and the two neighbors went down our lonely road and drove around. And then they saw flames and they found the body and the car burnt out. And unfortunately, he had been murdered. And they called the police, but the police wouldn't come out because they were afraid that it was a hoax or a trap. So they waited until the morning with the body, my dad and the neighbors. Just, you know, this is on this small country road. So that's a beautiful song, There Were Roses, about that time. But, you know, I have to say my parents did a wonderful job, even though they were living through this, of keeping politics from us. As we were kids, I mean, we used to see helicopters, and that was the most exciting thing you'd see in the country. Right. Helicopters. And I remember even when we bought the shop, it was in Newry and it was a pretty Republican area. And I remember kids coming in shouting up the Ra, and I had to go home and ask my parents who the Ra were because I didn't actually know at 11. We weren't watching the news. It feels a bit like that movie, It's a Beautiful Life, or Life is Beautiful, in the Oscar winning one. You know, my parents did a phenomenal job of keeping that from us until we were teenagers. And, you know, I remember even being in school and there were a couple of girls in my class from South Armagh who came from very different backgrounds. And I was given out about the IRA or some bombing. And they basically said, Pauline, you're not living in the same Northern Ireland she wouldn't have said Northern Ireland either. You're not living in the same place that I'm living. And, you know, her family were potentially involved. And, you know, she used to have the British soldiers coming in at 3 a.m. on a wet night and putting them all out into the street, putting a rifle in her 6-year-old sister's face, ransacking the place, and then coming back and doing it 3 nights later. That was not my experience. So she, you know, and I used to get a bit of grief when I came to New York in the beginning for not being more of a Republican that I should have been. And to be honest, I didn't know Sinn Féin. I knew that Gerry, you know, the news was something that was really boring that Daddy would put on at night and my parents would watch it obviously religiously because it wasn't like 24-hour news. You didn't have the social media. I mean, the news would come on and interrupt your cartoons and you didn't really understand. And the news cycle was like the killing, then, you know, the next day the reaction, and then the third day the funeral. I mean, the news was just all depressing. So my parents did a phenomenal job, I think, in protecting us from that in many ways. But, you know, since coming to New York and frankly, educating myself a little bit better on what was happening in Northern Ireland, it's very hard. You know, I met Martin McGuinness on many occasions. I've met Gerry Adams on a number of occasions. And and particularly in the the late 90s, when, you know, Gerry Adams coming to New York was still very much a very touchy subject. One of my dear, dear supporters of the Irish Arts Centre said, I need you to fill a table at the Sinn Féin dinner. And I was like, oh my God, my mother's going to kill me. If I'm, you know, and it was a very difficult time. Even do I want to be photographed at a Sinn Féin dinner? Then, you know, you go and everybody's, you know, I might get grief for saying this about, you know, but I remember listening to Gerry Adams and I'd never really heard his story before. And he was telling the story how he grew up in Ballymurphy and there was a woman who was a mother of six, had been killed as part of the Ballymurphy massacre. And at the same time, that song, Where's Your Mama Gone? Where's Your Mama Gone? Was popular in the charts. And Gerry said that the Brits used to come in, British soldiers used to come in and play that over the airways outside the home of that woman of 31 who'd left six kids behind. So, you know, I'm a very passionate person. I fortunately didn't have to choose. I had the luxury of being a pacifist in the rolling hills of South Down. And, you know, as I say, growing up very, you know, with Protestant, actually my grandfather was Protestant on my dad's side as well. So I didn't have to choose. But I do remember being in Dublin and feeling this hulking figure. And it must have been my early days of being a student down in Dublin. And I remember thinking, oh, British soldier, and turning around and seeing like a German backpacker, German tourist come with a backpacker. And it was one of the first times I realized how indoctrinated, how, you know, how it just, that was my go-to. When someone was hulking behind me with a large rucksack, I was thinking, oh, they're the British soldiers. You know, when I became a teenager, obviously I was more aware of it than when we were kids living in the country because my school was in Newry. And, you know, so you'd see, you'd feel something and you'd be in your Catholic schoolgirl uniform. And, you know, the young lads, because they were British soldiers, were like, what, 18, 19? They could have been in Cyprus getting a tan or whatever. And they're in Northern Ireland. And, you know, you could feel them and you'd feel the sights. You know, they'd be following you in their sights because they're 19-year-old kids and you're like 16, 17 in a uniform. And so it just, but my dad always said, look, they're not the ones giving the orders. You know, we were taught at checkpoints just to say, yes, sir, no, sir, you know, which is not everyone's, not how every parents advise their kids in Ireland during that very turbulent time. But the most phenomenal thing is, you know, my nieces and nephews are now in the 25, 26, 27, and they have no cognizance whatsoever. They all grew up in Northern Ireland and very little cognizance of anything just 25 years later, which is just so uplifting. When I went to Dublin, I went to a local primary school that was all Catholic. I went to an all girls Catholic school. And when I went to Dublin, I had a couple of Northerners in my class and just religion was never talked about. It was never even mentioned. And actually what was really amazing, now that I think back, is going to college, I was absolutely amazed how little people knew about what was happening in Northern Ireland. We're talking Newry is an hour north of Dublin Airport. How little people knew and frankly, how little people cared. None of the people in my class who were from the South had any interest in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, I'd have to say that, you know, my experience as somebody that grew up in North Dublin, which would probably be even less than maybe an hour from Newry, it was another world to us in a way. It was on the other side of the border. It played out in the background and occasionally it would burst the borders and come down to Dublin. You know, this year is the 50th anniversary of the bombings in Dublin. But yeah, it was like another place in the world. But you're talking about, you know, you came to Dublin, you took a degree in Trinity College in theater, and yet you didn't want to act. So how do we square that peculiarity? Are you just a rare bird in that respect, or did you find other members, other students that were similarly minded? And I'm interested in theater, but I'm not interested in acting.
Well, you know, the beauty, it was a course in drama and theater studies. And the beautiful thing is it was not geared towards acting. We did have some wonderful actors, Jason O'Mara, Justine Mitchell, we did have an acting program at the time, but this was a four-year degree, who wanted to pursue performing, but also wanted to have a degree. But, you know, the beautiful thing is, you know, and particularly having been in the theater business for 25 years, there are so many different roles behind the scenes that people don't see. And frankly, the acting one, I couldn't stand around. I mean, as well as not being a very good liar, I was just like up ladders helping. I mean, I had to do it as part of the course, but I was just not my cup of tea. I was too fascinated by the lights. So there was the lighting design. I did all that. The, you know, obviously sound design, set design, stage management, which, you know, and to be honest, like sometimes the acting is not the most powerful role in the room. You're not in the driving seat, so, which is why I kind of love the producing and directing, because I like getting things done. So being a producer, you can bring the talent together, you bring the writers together, you bring everybody together, work with the directors. But, you know, there's a lot more. You don't have to stand around and wait for your line or wait to be told what to do. And, you know, it's looking, we just had a visit from Sharon Horgan, who just did Bad Sisters and Catastrophe. And, you know, she's someone I greatly admire. And, you know, creating roles for women and for, you know, there's so much that goes on that people don't see when the curtains go up. And that kind of the whole process fascinated me more so than being a performer. And, you know, I don't really have, I'm kind of was lucky in a way that I had a foot and a deep appreciation for the arts, but I also enjoyed the business side of things and enjoyed a lot. I wouldn't consider myself an artist, which I think part of the reason for my long tenure at the Arts Centre is that, you know, a lot of artists had run the organization before. So I think it's important to have someone who's not an artist running it, so that you're focused on all aspects, not just, you know, the acting part of it or the performing, or not just standing in the wings hoping for somebody to break a leg so you can literally, understudy and sweep in. So it was never about creating roles for me. It was about trying to create opportunities for other people.
Pauline, you already told us, I mean, it seems like, you know, your career, it seems so inevitable at this point, you know, to us, like looking back, what would the Irish Arts Centre be without Pauline? But you already alluded to the fact that it was really a roll of the dice, or in this case, a random number popping up in the lottery system for visas that brought you over here. Tell us about, you know, the changes for you coming over to New York, throwing yourself into a very different lifestyle here, and then quickly finding your way.
Well, you know, I have to say I got very involved in the student drama group when I was in Trinity called Players. And at that time, it was actively encouraged. I don't know if it is as much now, where it was kind of separation between the drama students and the amateur league. But, you know, we were putting on 40 plays a week. So, and I was involved in because no one else wanted to be, I was the treasurer at the end of my first year, and I inherited, it's kind of a long running, you know, it's not the first time I inherited an organization kind of in debt, which at that time was maybe 2,500, but for a student organization was huge. They had put on Dante's Inferno in the Buttery. And it had cost the organization, the society rather. So Dublin University Players Society, which was started in the early, I think like 1928 or something. But so I kind of got involved there, and I started a accounting system where, you know, they used to, you had a budget of $90 if you did a lunchtime play, and 90 pounds, I guess maybe even pounds. And then 120 if you did an evening show. And that money was given to the students, and then they were supposed to turn in receipts. So I controversially decided that, implemented that you you had to return in the receipts and then you got the money. So to set up the checks and balances so that we could make sure to dig ourselves out of the hole that we had gotten in. So I had a little bit of experience in that. And, you know, and we were marketing the plays, we were doing costume. And so when I went to New York for 6 months, I really just wanted to get some experience to put on my CV, my resume when I went back home. And I looked up, and you know, it's so funny. We take the internet so much for granted, but I literally looked up the Yellow Pages when I got to New York because I didn't know, I honestly didn't know anyone who lived in New York. And I got the bus to Port Authority. Now, I did have friends in New Jersey and I'd spent the night, a couple of nights in New Jersey, but I took the bus up from there to find, I bought the Irish Echo newspaper and looked at the listings in the back. And found, you know, it was like Woodside, Sunnyside. I had no Google Maps. I had no idea how to even get to any of these places. But there was an ad that said 2 minutes from Times Square. And I literally remember reading it on the corner of 42nd and 8th Avenue outside Port Authority. And I thought, well, I know where Times Square is. I'll be able to find it. And it literally was 43rd and 8th Avenue, which was my first apartment.
Sounds very colorful there, Pauline.
It was very colorful. And, you know, the funny thing was I saw two apartments. There was another one on 57th Street, which I knew I could find. So I went up there first because the other woman I called, she said, I can meet you after work. And this other lady could meet me during work hours. So I walked up and Kennedy's Bar, which I absolutely loved. I'm so sad it's not there on 57th Street, was open. So I went in to get a bowl of soup and a bit of lunch. And there was this wonderful man from Donegal, Martin, behind the bar. And, you know, he asked me what I was doing. I said, oh, I'm just going to go and look at an apartment. He goes, who's going with you? And I was like, oh, I hadn't thought of that. And he was like, write down the number, give me the apartment number, and you come straight back here when you've seen the apartment. And if you're not back in 20 minutes, I'm coming up to get you. Mm-hmm. And the thought hadn't even crossed my mind. I was so naive. You know, so I actually found out that I did know someone in New York, a girl who'd spent a year in Trinity, and I got in touch with her to come and look at the second apartment with me. But I was very, very fortunate. I went to look at the Stagehands Union thinking that it was like props that I had done in college. And I went in, and of course, they're like Broadway stagehands. They're like teamsters, basically, you know, burly guys who move huge Broadway sets. And I went in my little pencil skirt and my nice blouse to ask about joining, you know, the stagehands. And they were like, she didn't laugh in my face. She was very kind. And she, you know, said, well, are you in the union? I was like, no. And what do you have to do? And they were like, well, you have to be earning $50,000 a year, which was like, okay, what if you're not in the union? Well, you can come in and sign in the morning. And I go into the little room filling out the forms and I look over at the four burly guys sitting across from me and realized, I think I've got this wrong. So I walked out and I literally looked up and there was a sign that said O'Flaherty's Ale House Garden Open. And I went straight in there and said, you know, I'm looking for a job. And the woman said, we're not hiring right now. And I said, well, I just moved in round the corner. Can I give him? And then she said, are you Irish? She heard my accent. And she says, hold on a minute, have a seat. And her husband came around the corner, the legendary Tony O'Flaherty. And I think that probably being an O'Flaherty's just automatically created a family for me. I don't know if you know it. It's on 46th Street. All the theater actors used to come and hang out there after shows. But the two waitresses are still my best friends to this day. Actually, one of them just visited the New Irish Arts Centre last month with her teenage daughters. They were in New York for the weekend, both girls from St. Louis. That just created a family, and I didn't have time to be lonely because I was working like six shifts a week. And then, so I had my afternoons off, I also nannied a couple of afternoons, but I had three afternoons off. So I said, I'm going to go and volunteer somewhere that I can put it on my resume. And that's when I looked up the phone book, Irish in the phone book, and it said Irish Art Center, Irish Repertory Theatre, and I think Irish Guide Dogs for the Blind. So I went to both the Art Center and the Irish Rep, and I still slag Kieran O'Reilly, who's one of my dearest friends, that, you know, he promised me some box office work in 97 and he didn't deliver on it, you know. So, but that's how it started. I went in and they were like, when can you start? So I interned for about 3-4 months, and then, you know, kind of life took over, the season ended. And then I got a call the following year from Nye Heron, who'd been running the organization for about 25 years, and asking me to would I go for a cup of coffee? And I went for a cup of coffee and he forgot his wallet, which should have been a taste of things to come. I bought the coffees. He offered me a job, asked me how little I could work for. And I figured it out. I lowballed it as, you know, because I really wanted to the experience and foolishly lowballed it. And because I had my waitressing on the side as well. So Nye hired me in, that was in April of 98, 25 years, April 6, 98, I started full time. I'd been interning in 97. And about 2 weeks into the job, he went to Dublin to make a film with Jim Sheridan. I think they were doing The Boxer at the time, if I'm not mistaken. And yes, it was, because I did some sound voiceover crowd scenes for them because they needed additional AD with the Nordy accents. And he went to Dublin and basically said, he did have a mobile number, and he said, only call me if it's an emergency. So that was my onboarding. And he basically never came back. So I was 23, 24. And I basically was like, okay. And the phones were ringing and someone said, I've rented the theater. I have a show coming in. So I was just like, so you're saying about how my, it was like, this was kind of a, I was like, okay, it's grown up players. It's players for actually real money and real people. Not that it wasn't in Dublin. I made some of my most incredible friends who went on to become great theater makers and artists, but you know, the stakes were a lot higher. Yeah, so that's kind of how we had a wonderful show, wonderful group, people who are still my friends. Actually, Larry Kerwin was just at the Art Center. Larry was coming in with a show called Liverpool Fantasy and in 98. And I just kind of had to go, okay, I got to figure this out. And so it was just me and a part-time person at that time. And then we got more volunteers involved. And then we had to figure out ways to hire the volunteers because they were doing such an incredible job. And the budget, I think at that time, was 120,000 for the year. And I think I left about 5,000 or 6,000 in the bank. So I didn't actually get paid my very lucrative $400 a week or something for 5 months, because we didn't have any money to. Yeah. And so when you're thinking about people saying, you know, walking on air, I remember this one lawyer saying to me, but Pauline, you know, what's your, who's your contract? And I was like, my contract with whom? It's just me in the office. And I know I'm crazy, but you know, when you're 24, like I probably wouldn't have done it if I'd come in with even 4 or 5 years more experience, but because I was literally right out of college and not intending to stay, I was like, okay, well, let me just roll up my sleeves, see what I can do. And, that was 90. I was just kind of so busy trying to play catch up and, you know, trying to raise a little money. And actually the first fundraiser we did in 1998 was with Aidan Quinn. Night November had played at the Irish Arts Centre and then it moved to 42nd Street. And Nye had said, I had opened an envelope one day and it was a membership check and it said Aidan Quinn. I was like, not like Aidan Quinn, Aidan Quinn. And I said to Nye, it must have been that first 2 weeks he was there. And he was like, yeah, yeah, Aidan's been a member for years. He's a great guy. If you ever need him to do anything, he's great. So I got in touch with Aidan in 98 and said, you know, this show is going to Broadway. Would you do a night for us? Can we do like a pre-show supper or a party, a reception, and then take people to the show, which is what we did. And he brought Siobhan O'Casey, Sean O'Casey's daughter. And that was my, I don't know how much money we raised. I can't even remember. You know, so many of the early days, it's just like the stress of keeping the place open. I've forgotten some of the details, but Aidan has stayed a dear friend to the organization. He's been absolutely lovely. And then I guess the turning point was in 2000 when Gabriel got involved and we kind of really got passionate about, you know, how do we make this a better organization. And Sal Donaghy from Structure, or from Sweeney and Harkin, Structure Tone had been involved, big construction company, had been involved in the 80s in renovating the Arts Centre and kind of keeping it up and renovating the theatre. And Sal was an amazing part. So he, you know, we had to reconstitute the board of directors and Sal became the chairman and is still on the board to this day. He's a phenomenal person and his son, Kevin. And I remember he faxed me a check for $1,000 for an event. And I was like, oh my, and I almost passed out, you know, and that's how long ago it was. It was fax and sat me down. There's so many stories, but Sal had just been amazing.
Let me ask you a little bit about sort of the vision behind the Irish Arts Center. I was looking at an interview that you had done and someone asked you, how do you define Irish? And you said you had a global vision of Irish. And that's something that Martin and I talk about all the time. The Irish Arts Center is really marked by the cross-cultural connections you make. I think of Mick Maloney's winter solstice celebrations as a prime example for me of that happening. There's old views of Ireland in America. There's a contemporary view going on at the Irish Arts Center. Tell us a little bit about the vision for the sort of artistic output of the Irish Arts Center.
I have to say, John, I mean, really, our mission back even in 1972 has always been about Irish culture and sharing it with people of all backgrounds. And even back then on Monday nights, they used to have a session and they'd always invite another culture in to perform a song. So it was, you know, Brian Heron, who's the grandson of Connolly, James Connolly, was one of the original founders, an absolute visionary. There's a lot of things he's been called, but a visionary and, you know, very passionate about the Irish language. And so, you know, it's always been kind of at the core, though, as, you know, when Sheridan took over, they primarily became better known for off Broadway. But the music and dance was always part of it. So I really want to, you know, so I was the executive director for almost 10 years. And then, you know, I did have a vision of going back to Ireland at one point. And we had a search and, you know, I'd worked a number of times with Aidan Connolly, who's our phenomenal executive director. And so I was like, Aidan, your country needs you. And he said, well, I'm only taking the job if you give me 2 years. Because at that point, Gabriel and I had started the annual galas, or he'd gotten really involved. So, and he got Liam Neeson involved. So, you know, we'd gone up to, you know, we were raising maybe 800,000 a year. I'm investing all that back into the organization. But, you know, to take it to the next level, we knew if we needed to build a new building, we needed to build a new board, we needed to build a bigger team. And Aidan was really the man for the job with half his background in politics and the other half in the arts. So, you know, we had the lug being multidisciplinary, which we had been in our history, but, you know, we'd kind of sidelined into theater. It's been really great to see, you know, just leaning back into the multidisciplinary aspect, because then you're, you know, relevant to so many more people. There's only a certain amount of people in New York who enjoy theater and particularly Irish theater. But when you bring music into a more enriched experience and you're bringing now contemporary dance, which we can do in the new space, the literature programs, the humanity programs, you know, and we've always taught 40 classes a week in Irish language, history, music and dance. We don't talk a lot about the education program, but it's been phenomenal. And since COVID, a bunch of those classes are online as well. So the multidisciplinary aspect of it has just been really, really exciting to all what, you know, and you see it yourself, John. I know you're a regular going, you know, the programming, and I'm not on the programming side of things anymore. I have to say it's just extraordinary. It's just, I'm so proud of Aidan and Rachel Gilkey, who's our director of programming and their team for the phenomenal curation. It just makes me proud. I know that I can invite anyone to anything because the level and the quality of the work is so high that they're not going to be disappointed. But the multicultural, I have to say, like I mentioned earlier, the Liam O'Mahony and Cassandra Wilson project, which was something that we did as a fundraiser. We were doing a groundbreaking and we put Liam and Cassandra on stage for the first time singing Tubular Honey from Van Morrison, because they'd both covered it separately. And it was just so electric. We were like, oh my God, we have to do this. So we gave a residency. And, you know, to hear Liam singing Oscuilga on the piano and Cassandra translating into jazz, having jazz musicians and Irish trad musicians, it just feels so new. And it has to be, because an Irish art center is never going to survive or thrive in New York if it's not relevant to New Yorkers of all backgrounds.
Yeah. It certainly seems that I look at the Irish Arts Center now and I remember it in the old tenement building. That's an incredible arc, and the quality of the programming, you know, just continues to get better and better. Talk to me a little bit about the business side of things. How do you go from a $100,000 budget to a $60 million capital raise? I think about, what, 7 or 8 years ago when you realized, okay, tenement building ain't cutting it with buckets on the stage when, you know, the current or former Taoiseach, Micheál Martin is visiting. Of course, he wasn't Taoiseach then. But what does it take to make that happen? Because that's kind of a phenomenal story.
Well, you know, time, as much as we'd wanted to happen in a tighter time frame and a shorter time frame, time actually, you know, has been our friend. A couple of huge factors, you know, I mentioned hiring Aidan, who had, you know, has a Wharton, a business degree from Wharton, who's phenomenal. We also happen to be in Christine Quinn's district. So we get Liam and Gabriel involved. We start raising the profile to a certain point, and that's how we got from 100,000 to 800,000. Of course, we had 9/11 in the middle of that, which, you know, hurt all arts organizations. When Aidan came on, you know, I think we were probably around maybe 6 or 7. We'd gone down a little bit after 9/11. But the annual galas, you know, with Liam and Gabriel's help, we were able to honour great people like Daniel Day-Lewis and Jimmy Fallon, and, you know, just bring in, as well as on the philanthropic side, you know, start building a board. And then, you know, so the board development was really huge. You know, we are so incredibly lucky to have the phenomenal board that we have, led by Belfast man Sean Kelly, who former partner at KPMG, which is another side of things. Like, when your chairman of your board is from KPMG, like the auditing and everything, you know, the financials, to be able to stand behind those is so important, particularly when, as you say, you're going from this small organization into this huge capital project. So we, you know, Aidan and I have always been about, let's raise the money and then hire the best people for the job. So we worked with, I'll go back to raising the money in a second, but we worked with Jonathan Rose, owner's rep, who've built many of the big cultural institutions. So we knew what, you know, they knew exactly what they were doing, building the board. And then, the construction, they obviously held our hands going through all the construction, making sure that we could afford the best contractors. Now, everybody's like, it's, you know, you're Irish. Irish built the city. Get them to do it for free. That's not how it works when you're spending city dollars and union. And the thing with the city, everything had to be fully funded in order to be able to start construction. So we were in Christine Quinn's district, and Christine, you know, was very, very generous in her time as speaker, because she saw, you know, the capital project, the capital money is there in the capital budget city every year. And because it took so long, we'd apply every year and maybe get a little bit more, get a little bit more, get a little bit more. And the brilliant thing about Aidan, having spent half his time in public arena, we were able to get money from the Irish government, you know, from New York State and New York City to cover most of the capital costs. And then, you know, we also, more importantly, like you say, you know, we're growing into this big building to bring along, you know, the stalwarts in the Irish community, like Loretta Brennan-Glucksman. Loretta's been on our board for a number of years. Bob McCann from UBS, John Duffy, Jim Quinn from Tiffany's, you know, just phenomenal people who helped us really build the foundation for the private. And the galas were a big part of that, just every year, making sure that we were building in our annual fund, so that money wasn't going into the building, but it was going into making sure that we were able to staff up, that we were able to afford this new building. And it's still, you know, we still have lots of opportunities for people to get involved. What we've been able to achieve, I think, with a relatively, you know, I think there's just so much opportunity for more people to get involved and feel ownership. You know, we're constantly doing events, encouraging people to get more involved as well.
So when I think of the Irish Arts Centre, I think of it as part of a rectangle in Manhattan, anchored by the Irish Arts Centre, Glucksman House, the Irish Rep, and of course the troubled American Irish Historical Society, which is now obviously going through a restructuring process. And I had some involvement there. So to some degree, your answer to that question is kind of really helpful when I'm thinking about, you know, the future for that organization. But my question is, how do those institutions cooperate with each other? Or is it a rivalry, or is it both?
It's one of the great things about Aidan and Rachel when they're doing the programming. They're like, oh, this is something that would be great for Glucksman Ireland to partner with us. John knows. So if we're doing a literary event, and in fact, you know, we just did the tributes to Mick Maloney, which the Glucksman Ireland House were very heavily involved in helping fund that project. So Aidan and Rachel have always been about, this is not about an upgrade for the Irish Arts Centre. This is about a new cultural institution for Irish America and how do we work. So we sat down with all the institutions, Charlotte and Kieran, saying, look, how can this be good for you? How can we work? And, you know, literally just a few days ago, Kieran was texting me, then an actor that we had worked with, they were going to Dublin to see his show. And he was like, I'd love him to say hello to folks afterwards. Can you send me his details? And I'm like, absolutely. Or if I know, we know that someone who's a good supporter of ours is going down to see a show at the Irish Rep, will be like, Kieran, heads up, you know, this person's in the house tonight. If you don't know who they are, you know, it's always been, we joke that when we go to events where we should be networking with other people, we're stuck in the corner talking to each other because we just enjoy each other so much. So particularly with, you know, with the Rep and with Glucksman, very, very warm, very, they're colleagues, if you will. Although we don't do a lot of partnerships in the same way with the Irish Rep that we do with Glucksman, because I mean, Glucksman don't have a performing arts venue. You know, we share resources in terms of lighting, set people behind the scenes and all of the above. With the, you know, the Historical Society, as you know, has been a different situation. So we haven't had as much collaboration. Although Sophie Colgan, who's been very instrumental, Sophie worked on our gala last year with us, and she's wonderful. And she's a County Down woman, so I have to give her a shout out. She's great.
I think the Irish Rep showed what was possible with the American Irish Historical Society with the staging of the Dead.
Exactly.
Just spectacular. Well, let's go right up to the moment here at the Irish Arts Center. And I'll just tell a little tale here that seems to encapsulate a lot about the Irish Arts Center for me. I was at the opening, the reception for Good Vibrations, a punk rock musical, and looking through the window down the beautiful bar area, there's a traditional Irish dance class going on. I don't know the terminology, sort of a square dance type of
set dance.
Yeah. Yeah, set dance. So that was it. You know, set dance in one corner, traditional Irish culture, Irish folks enjoying it, and then getting ready for a punk rock musical from Belfast.
You know, that's what it is. It's about, you know, we do think very carefully about how we're attracting new audiences. You know, our most recent show, Conversations After Sex, raised a few eyebrows as well. But, you know, then 2 weeks later, we had the phenomenal tributes to Mick Maloney with 33 of the highest caliber of traditional Irish artists, musicians and dancers on stage. So that's really what it's about. It's about how to keep those opportunities alive and not be in one lane. You know, it's Aidan often says it's not about taking a sledgehammer to history. It's, you know, looking forward, but also, you know, recognizing the greatness from which we came and paying making sure we're paying homage. Because, you know, if you've seen Martin Hayes live, to see Martin in our new space with the sound is just phenomenal. We just had Paul Brady last weekend, which was just incredible. At 76, we celebrated Paul's 76th birthday with him. He looked like a 50-year-old up there. You know, but then we had the Pillow Queens, which was, you know, a phenomenal stand-up gig. I had to Google them. I didn't know who they were, embarrassingly, but the young folks do. So it's really important for us to be building for the next generation, as well as, you know, paying respects to, and frankly, just good business sense, because there's a huge, you know, traditional Irish community in New York. And it's just about maintaining our relevance in so many different pockets.
You know, I just want to mention we're heading towards the curtain. I just wanted to mention one other element before we get to our shameless plug. While the tremendous project of opening the Irish Arts Center was in its gestation, you had another very major and very important project that was in gestation as well. Tell us about Lily.
Lily, yeah. So I used to joke that I forgot to get married and have kids. I got distracted by the Irish Arts Center in my 20s and 30s. So I didn't meet my husband until I was in my 40s. And, you know, then we were trying for many years to have a family, IVF and all the rest. And so our little bundle of joy, I was 48 when Miss Lily finally showed up. And so people say to me, congratulations. And I'm like, never sure if it's me, if they're talking about Lily or if they're talking about the new Irish Arts Centre. I feel like both babies, I was literally 8 months pregnant on stage at our last gala before she was born. And I, you know, people saying, well, you know, I went 4 weeks early or 6 weeks early. I was like, I don't want to hear that. You know, I don't want to hear those stories. She's not coming out until, till after the gala. So the, it's been a roller coaster of a year. She's 16 months now and an absolute blessing, an absolute blessing. And yeah, but keeping me very much on my toes. And she came to her first show at 4 months. So she's a regular at the Arts Centre on the weekends because my nanny does a lot of nights during the week. I don't want to push it. But yeah, so that time you mentioned good vibes. Yeah, so we're so excited. That's going to be starting on June 14th. Running for a month. We're so excited. I think we have 28 artists coming over from Belfast. So it's going to be a riot on and off the stage, I suspect. And it's a very busy week that week. This coming week, June 11th, we have June 13th, we have our Tuesday, June 13th, we have our golf tournament, which is out in Port Washington. And it's, I think, our 21st golf tournament. So that's yet another, Martin, you're asking about how do we get from here, from there to here, through the great leadership of our chairman, the former chairman, Jerry Boyle, and Andy Breslin, who's a phenomenal supporter, and the Mike Cardys of the world. We've been golfing for the last 20 years. And then on Thursday of that same week, we also have our Women of Irish Arts Luncheon, which we do to celebrate the great women in our orbit, the ones on stage and behind the scenes. So that's at the Metropolitan Club. So lots of opportunities for people to get more involved.
That's great. And it feels like to me that you preempted poor old Seamus' plug there, you know. So is there something else now that we're drawing to a curtain, as John would put it, that you want to add for Seamus, since he's feeling kind of a bit left out in the cold?
Oh, sorry. I overstepped my cue. I thought I was supposed to
it
Seamus plug. So
it
yeah, I'll just
happens.
Reiterate, you know, well, actually I will do another plug for those people who saw the incredible Michael Murphy, the man in the woman's shoes, and I Hear You and Rejoice. We just had Michael doing a writer's residence. So he's going to be coming back in the fall to do his third and final trilogy. So for people who know Michael Murphy, if you don't know him, you are, that's a great loss in your life for not knowing Michael Murphy, the incredible performer from Sligo. And that's going to be coming in the fall. So we'll probably be announcing over the summer, but the good vibes for sure. And we also have a Devlin Cafe, so people can come for a drink before the show as well. But we're so proud of what we've built, all built together. It takes a village. And, you know, we're so proud of everyone and what we've achieved together. So we want everybody who cares about Ireland and Irish America to come and check it out. And we look forward to seeing everybody there.
Yeah, it's an absolutely lovely space. And I've had the pleasure of having a couple of drinks in the bar before a performance or an event. And it's just a really inviting space. It's such an incredible upgrade from the original tenement situation.
All the furniture was made in Ireland. So you'll see 3,000-year-old Connemara marble and Armagh granite on the high tops. And so it was all a fabulous Aurier furniture company who happened to be from Newry, but I wasn't actually involved in that selection process, but it's really beautiful. We get a lot of comments on it. So it's nice to be sitting on a piece of Ireland or in interacting. We, you know, it's important for us that the building look like, you know, artistry happens there. So I think the guys did a phenomenal job.
And so with that, what I would say is, folks, you've got to check this place out. If you haven't been to the Irish Arts Centre, get there. If you don't know anything about it, just pop in Irish Arts Centre, New York, in your Google machine, and it'll come right up. There's a great schedule there, both of educational programs, but also performance programs. And of course, I'm looking forward to good vibrations. Got to have some punk in your life.
Well, I hope all our listeners in the area get out. It was described as the most ambitious production so far, and the very, very ambitious productions in the history of the Irish Arts Center. Sounds exciting coming over from the Lyric Theater in Belfast, I believe. So a lot of great cross connections here, and we look forward to joining you there. And we know you will keep walking on air against your better judgment.
Yes, thank you. Thank you all both for what you're doing and keeping us all connected, particularly in the COVID era and beyond. It's been really important. So thank you.
Thanks, Pauline.
Martin, I loved learning about Pauline's career arc, where it starts in County Down, hardworking family, ends up at Trinity. And I really was impressed by her series of happy accidents that led her to where she is today. And of course, those accidents have luck involved, but they're also only possible through persistence, through hard work, which really comes through all throughout her story, and an openness to opportunity.
Yeah, and one thing that struck me, Pauline's resume is quite simple. Her whole professional career is with the Irish Arts Center. But what's fascinating about her career is the arc of that organization itself. It started off when she first showed up there. It was hosted in a tenement, and now it is a world-class, state-of-the-art art center. And there's something about that that is also tracking the story of the shift in Ireland itself. We've gone from being an impoverished country to a highly sophisticated country, and who better to lead it than Pauline?
Yeah, and they also reflect the changes of a progressive modern Ireland with cross-cultural influences and the kind of programming they do. I mentioned the idea that we're at a reception for a punk rock musical while in the next room, traditional Irish set dancing is going on. And I loved hearing towards the end there the sense of cooperation and collaboration that Pauline left us with the various other leading Irish cultural organizations in New York. That was nice to hear.
Yeah, it's a big old global Irish nation pie. And so everybody can have a slice, and even better, make sure everybody else gets cream put on top of it.
But also, only after you've had your stew.
Irish Stew is produced by John Lee, Martin Nutty, and Bill Schultz. Editing, mixing, and mastering by Bill Schultz. Music on Irish Stew was composed and performed by Rosa Nutty, with Donal Bowens on drums, Cathal O'Riordan on bass and synthesizer. For more on Rosa Nutty's music, please visit rosanutty.com.